Hey everybody, Solidarity House Cooperative is now on iTunes and Spotify, as well as Podbean and Patreon. You can go to Patreon to support us and any of those platforms to hear us.
Disposable Man is a novel about an American living in contemporary Berlin. He's a man whose wife has left him. All the men in his family have had their female partners leave. It's also about a lot more than that. And Michael Levitin, my friend and my editor, wrote the book, and he's here with me now. So in what way is this an autobiography of Mike Levitin?
It is in many ways. An aspect of family, most of all. I took a lot of my own personal family stories, my grandparents, my great aunt, who is really the central character of the narrative that takes place in the past and during World War II. These are family stories that, in a sense, I don't know if haunted is the right word, but they certainly were with me since I was a young boy hearing them. They fled the Holocaust. My grandparents jumped from city to city, finally left Prague in 1938 when Hitler came into the Sudetenland. But it was really my great aunt, my grandmother's sister, whose story about surviving her first winter in a Siberian work camp, thanks to a postcard that she sent to Albert Einstein, that was the story in my family that I knew I could never quite let go of without really diving into it. And once I dove in, I decided to tell a contemporary story about a contemporary man, and that became the novel. And that's also quite taken from my experience of living for 5 years in Berlin, a city that I really got to know, and it's a kind of a love-hate. It's such a complex, rich, historical, interesting city, and also the people I knew there. I wanted to turn some of that into fiction. So I think both elements, it is a novel, it's fictional. Characters, there's no Michael Levitin in it, but there are certainly my life experiences and stories.
So there's a lot of displacement in the book, and I want to ask about that, but before I do, how much of this is a book about the displacement of late capitalism? It's not women's empowerment that's displaced men. Women's empowerment has sharpened, relationships have changed for sociological reasons or whatever. But there's been this decline in the stability of capitalism and in liberal institutions and in conservative institutions. Is this a book, in what way is this a book about capitalism?
I think you're right. It's an interesting question. Probably not many people are going to frame it like that when talking about the book. But I guess you could say that the transition of women much more into the workplace and much more taking a much stronger role in the capitalist system, in the family, in their own careers, in their pursuit of, becoming as much a part of this economic system, which then changes your social role, your role in society. I think it gets to our shift as a culture into sort of a post-capitalist or hyper-capitalist where everything is kind of, there's a section in the book about consumer goods that everybody in comfortable cities like the kind of bourgeois, the Bobo neighborhood I lived in Berlin, Prenzlauer Berg, the overconsumption and the over-satisfaction with our own ease that we can buy anything we want and it's all designer made and it's all so cool and kitsch and easy and sort of a fluffy version of capitalism. And I think, I think you could say that Disposable Men, the Prenzlauer Berg man in the German context that I write about, and disposable men everywhere, I think feel the senselessness of our role as men, as people, women, men, but I'm talking about men here, our sort of uselessness in this capitalist, in this post-capitalist or uber, what you want to call it. It's sort of like there isn't much of a role for people now that we're just buying things and consuming them, and someone is producing them somewhere very cheaply, and what are we in this? I think that is a question, that you could say the book asks, what have men become?
As I'm reading this, I feel this sense of context and place and space and spatiality. And, you know, the arguments and discussions in the book take place in these very specific and very richly described material spaces, like the apartments and bars and stuff in Berlin.
It's a homage to Berlin. I mean, I grew into that city. It grew into me. The fact that my family is from there, that gave me, my grandparents, my grandmother and great aunt were both born in Berlin. It gave me, from the moment I moved there with my girlfriend at the time, who later became my wife briefly. But we lived there for 5 years. And from the moment I arrived, Berlin and its place were something I couldn't ignore, because it has somehow been in my bones in some way, or the experience of being there. It's a very human-sized city. It's very large. It's very spread out. It's hard to get around if you don't know Berlin. But the scale of it is a very different city. I would recommend to anyone who hasn't been simply to go, for whether it's a three-day weekend or go for several weeks or spend the whole summer there. It's a pretty magical city in that there really aren't tall buildings there. There's no skyscrapers in Berlin. It's very homey and cozy. It was built on a swamp centuries ago. It's a very poor, relatively. Germany is such a prosperous country, as many of us know, you know, one of the strongest economies in the world. But Berlin is famously unprosperous. The mayor, when I lived there, Klaus Wowereit, is city's first gay mayor and a very popular one, until they had an airport debacle, that the big airport they were planning to build that blew up on them and failed to open. But until then, he was very popular, and his motto was Berlin, Arm aber sexy, poor but sexy. And that somehow translated, I think, into my book, showing the poor but sexy Berlin, which I think a lot of us who are kind of enamored with Berlin for its gritty, funky little, you know, kind of definitely leftist and anti-capitalist mood, and the bars there, and the scene of sort of bohemian, of real bohemianism that still gets to thrive where it doesn't in other parts of other cities in Western Europe, other more affluent capitals, even in America. It's hard to find bohemian, uncapitalistic, and unstriving sort of people who are out more for the enjoyment and for the aesthetic, and the places that they can go and hide away, read a book in a nice cafe, and meet people and discuss, you know, over wine at 3 p.m, whatever places. I tried to capture the mood that was my poor but sexy Berlin. So yes, it is very placed there, and the apartments and the scene that I described, I guess it would be fair to say Berlin itself plays kind of a role. A
couple of passages that strike me in the book are the conversations that Max has with this character known as the Kaiser, including this final drink with the Kaiser. And at one point the Kaiser says, "More freedom. Of course we've got more freedom. Freedom for what?" And that, you know, that little paragraph there. And there's this weird juxtaposition of the loss of a sense of responsibility and this sort of loss of the sense of maybe manhood or masculinity. Where is that Kaiser's voice coming from?
Right.
Who's the Kaiser?
I think the Kaiser's a purely fictionalized character. Other characters in the book really do come from, taken off of guys, of friends of mine that were there, that I think I haven't hopefully offended or dishonored any of them, and I turned numerous people I know into characters, and they're in the book. But the Kaiser is, I think, a form of an alter ego of Max, who is Max Krum is the protagonist. He's the guy who's in search of his family's past. He's the guy who's wondering about his purpose now and feeling like a disposable man in today's culture and society. But the Kaiser, who is kind of an alter ego, they have these conversations, they're friends, and they share the same, a similar sense of loss. But the Kaiser is the guy in the book who is really obsessed with this sense of what have men become. He's a guy who's writing this giant, colossal script, as he calls it, a treatise on modern malehood. And he's trying to get to the core of what has gone on. What have we become? We changed, women changed. All of a sudden, men were looking for our new place, our new identity. But what many of us aren't. Why not? He's turning this over. So the conversations they have are kind of, you know, taking over beers and schnitzels and all the rest. They hash it out a bit, and I'm glad you appreciated the Kaiser's role. He's quite important, I think, in the book because he plays the most obsessively, somewhat, you know, torn. He's torn and doesn't even know really where he belongs, but he's resisting not talking about it. He demands that people face this question and ask, do we mean anything? And if so, what do we mean? What do men want now? What do we even desire? Do we have a purpose? Is there something we're here to accomplish? Do we even have ambition to do anything at all? He's asking that over and over, and that's sort of where those conversations go, and hopefully they go somewhere. They do, because the main character, I think, as the book comes to its end, he does discover something new and that evolves in him. So, you know, that's sort of the narrative and the direction.
I agree. I agree that the main character does, and that's a good thing, because I think if one looks at the blurbs for this book shallowly and doesn't look at the book more carefully and doesn't read the book, one might get the impression that the book is an unreflective expression of male rage. And so my question for you is, what do you feel your responsibility is as an author to where people might ideologically orient toward the book?
I think my responsibility as an author ended when I put the final period on the book and finished it, which was a lengthy process in itself. I mean, I'm not, that goes back to the, is it political? Look, I would hope that this isn't, I don't look at it as male rage, but I suppose that it does fit. It fits a bit with, you could even say, with the political moment we're in, where unfortunately the male rage is catalyzing a strong, more pro-male, more anti-politically correct, more bring us back to how men were previously. And this is some of the stuff that's helped elect Donald Trump as the president of the country. People afraid of embracing a more pluralist, a more diverse and equal and multi-voice society, and people who want to go back to when white men were white men and everyone else pretty much took the rule book that they gave them. I think that, so in that sense, it does play to the angst and the frustration that men are feeling of not really knowing, you know, not getting the respect, I guess you could say, but really not earning it, and not even not really doing anything in particular to deserve to hold some kind of former elevated place in our culture. They need to figure it out now. I think that my job or my point within the book is simply to have people read it and question and ask and have that open up the discussion. It isn't my expression of male rage. It's more, I think it's time that men need to frankly look at where we've come and where we need to evolve into, because clearly we're in a middle point between eras, between identities, kind of, and that would be the thing. I would certainly hope it doesn't create, or hope people don't get a reactionary and anti-woman, you know, anti-feminist sort of thing. Like, yeah, this is speaking to me in a kind of a rageful way, but more, I would hope, more contemplative and reflective and positive, because it isn't an anti-woman. This is not an anti-woman book. If anything, men are now looking at women with some form of a desire to be feeling as motivated as women are. Women are out doing a lot more, studying more, working more, striving more. They want more. And I think, in a way, that's what the book is trying to get at, that men, it's not women's fault. Women are taking what they deserve and what finally should be theirs to take, which is a more of a leading role in our economy, in our culture. And men need to think about it and ask, all right, so what now do we do, rather than sitting back and getting angry about it, for example.
Could you read maybe the passage in the book that you're proudest of, or that you really like?
From chapter 4, yeah. Just a few, two paragraphs that are sort of an intro to the disposable man theme.
Great.
I can do that. Get a sense, get away from the abstractions and get to the text itself. I wasn't always a disposable man. I'm not even sure how or when I became one. It isn't as if the condition hit me overnight. I didn't just wake up one morning to the baffling phenomenon like some Gregor Samsa. No, becoming disposable was something that happened gradually. It was a slow evolutionary ride down, bred into me and reinforced in such small doses that I almost didn't notice it occurring until the day I realized, quite simply, that I had become obsolete. I could feel my extinction coming on and was protestless to stop it. The absence of duty or requirements or a purpose of any kind may be what finally convinced me. The fact that I had no place to be and no time I had to be there. I wasn't in any great discomfort about it. It wasn't discomfort exactly. All I know is I had become disposable because I had lost, or more accurately, had failed to discover my function. I was functionless, that is, useless. But allow me, with the Kaiser's help, to clarify. The Kaiser explains it all better, see, because he's the one who got all this talk about our generation of disposable men banging around my head to begin with. The Kaiser called himself disposable, and he called me disposable too, because he said men in our time have lost the appetite for being men. He said we've grown weak, soft, with little to say and nothing to do, like a bunch of commas folded in on ourselves, missing life's explanation because we have lost the desires and abilities and qualities of men. Oh, the Kaiser, he has it all figured out. He talks about annihilated hopes and exhausted ambitions and no ladders worth climbing and all that sort of thing. He's even come up with a definition in the colossal text he's writing on the subject, where he defines disposable as, one, free to be used as the occasion requires, i.e. not assigned to any special use, and two, capable of being disposed of easily, i.e. designed to be thrown away. Both definitions imply potential use, use in the future or use in the past. But what they really mean, what disposable means for men like me and men like the Kaiser who are aching with the male potential inside us, is uselessness.
Michael Levitin is the author of Disposable Man, a brand new novel. And Michael, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure, Matt. Wonderful speaking.
We're Solidarity House on Patreon and Solidarity House Cooperative on Facebook and Twitter.